Chapter 36. Scientific things, which knew not woman, nor her sacrifices, nor her fears. In truth he was not only too young in years, but too literal, direct, and uncompromising in nature to understand such a woman as Lady Constantine. And she suffered for that limitation in him as it had been antecedently probable that she would do. He stayed but a little time at Cape Town on this his first reconnoitering journey, and on that account wrote to no one from the place. On leaving he found there remained some weeks on his hands, before he wished to cross to America, and feeling an irrepressible desire for further studies in navigation on shipboard, and under clear skies, he took the steamer for Melbourne, returning thence in due time, and pursuing his journey to America, where he landed at Boston. Having at last had enough of great circles and other nautical reckonings, and taking no interest in men or cities, this indefatigable scrutineer of the universe went immediately on to Cambridge, and there, by the help of an introduction he had brought from England, he reveled for a time in the glories of the gigantic refractor which he was permitted to use on occasion, and in the pleasures of intercourse with the scientific group around. This brought him on to the time of starting with the transit expedition, when he and his kind became lost to the eye of civilization behind the horizon of the Pacific Ocean. To speak of their doings on this pilgrimage, of ingress and egress, of tangent and parallax, of external and internal contact, would avail nothing. Is it not all written in the chronicles of the Astronomical Society? More to the point will it be to mention that Viviette's letter to Cambridge had been returned long before he reached that place, while her missive to Marseille was, of course, misdirected altogether. On arriving in America, uncertain of an address in that country at which he would stay long, Swithin wrote his first letter to his grandmother, and in this, he ordered that all communications should be sent to await him at Cape Town, as the only safe spot for finding him, sooner or later. The equatorial he also directed to be forwarded to the same place. At this time, too, he ventured to break Viviette's commands, and address a letter to her, not knowing of the strange results that had followed his absence from home. It was February. The transit was over, the scientific company had broken up, and Swithin had steamed towards the Cape, to take up his permanent abode there, with a view to his great task of surveying, charting and theorizing on those exceptional features in the southern skies which had been but partially treated by the younger Herschel. Having entered Table Bay and landed on the quay, he called at once at the post office. Two letters were handed him, and he found from the date that they had been waiting there for some time. One of these epistles, which had a weather-worn look as regarded the ink, and was in old-fashioned penmanship, he knew to be from his grandmother. He opened it, before he had as much as glanced at the superscription of the second. Besides immaterial portions, it contained the following. J. Reckon you know by now of our main news this fall, but lest you should not have heard of it, J. Send the exact thing snipped out of the newspaper. Nobody expected her to do it quite so soon, but it is said hereabout that my Lord Bishop and my Lady had been drawing nigh to an understanding before the glum tidings of Sir Blount's taking of his own life reached her, and the account of this wicked deed was so sore afflicting to her mind, and made her poor heart so timid and low, that in charity to my lady her few friends agreed on urging her to let the bishop go on paying his court as before, notwithstanding as he had not been a widow woman near so long as was thought. This, as it turned out, she was willing to do, and when my lord asked her, she told him she would marry him at once or never. That's as J was told, and J added from those that know. The cutting from the newspaper was an ordinary announcement of marriage between the Bishop of Melchester and Lady Constantine. Swithin was so astounded at the intelligence of what for the nonce seemed Viviette's wanton fickleness that he quite omitted to look at the second letter, and remembered nothing about it till an hour afterwards, when sitting in his own room at the hotel. It was in her handwriting, but so altered that its superscription had not arrested his eye. It had no beginning or date, but its contents soon acquainted him with her motive for the precipitate act. The few concluding sentences are all that it will be necessary to quote here. There was no way out of it, even if I could have found you, without infringing one of the conditions I had previously laid down. The long desire of my heart has been not to impoverish you or mar your career. The new desire was to save myself, and, still more, another yet unborn. I have done a desperate thing. Yet for myself I could do no better, and for you no less. I would have sacrificed my single self to honesty, but I was not alone concerned. What woman has a right to blight a coming life, to preserve her personal integrity? The one bright spot is that it saves you and your endowment from further catastrophes, and preserves you to the pleasant paths of scientific fame. I no longer lie like a log across your path, which is now as open as on the day before you saw me, and dear, I encouraged you to win me. Alas, Swithin, I ought to have known better. The folly was great, and the suffering be upon my head. I ought not to have consented to that last interview. All was well till then. Well, I have borne much, and am not unprepared. As for you, Swithin, by simply pressing straight on your triumph is assured. Do not communicate with me in any way, not even in answer to this. Do not think of me. Do not see me ever any more. Your unhappy Viviette. Swithin's heart swelled within him in sudden pity for her, first, then he blanched with a horrified sense of what he had done, and at his own relation to the deed. He felt like an awakened somnambulist who should find that he had been accessory to a tragedy during his unconsciousness. As he had loosened the knot of her difficulties by cutting it unscrupulously through and through. The big tidings rather dazed than crushed him, his predominant feeling being soon again one of keenest sorrow and sympathy. Yet one thing was obvious, he could do nothing, absolutely nothing. The event which he now heard of for the first time had taken place 5 long months ago. He reflected, and regretted, and mechanically went on with his preparations for settling down to work under the shadow of Table Mountain. He was as one who suddenly finds the world a stranger place than he thought, but is excluded by age, temperament, and situation from being much more than an astonished spectator of its strangeness. The Royal Observatory was about a mile out of the town, and hither he repaired, as soon as he had established himself in lodgings. He had decided, on his first visit to the Cape, that it would be highly advantageous to him if he could supplement the occasional use of the large instruments here by the use at his own house of his own equatorial, and had accordingly given directions that it might be sent over from England. The precious possession now arrived, and although the sight of it, of the brasses on which her hand had often rested, of the eyepiece through which her dark eyes had beamed engendered some decidedly bitter regrets in him for a time, he could not long afford to give to the past the days that were meant for the future. Unable to get a room convenient for a private observatory, he resolved at last to fix the instrument on a solid pillar in the garden, and several days were spent in accommodating it to its new position. In this latitude there was no necessity for economizing clear nights as he had been obliged to do on the old tower at Welland. There it had happened more than once that after waiting idle through days and nights of cloudy weather, Viviette would fix her time for meeting him at an hour when at last he had an opportunity of seeing the sky, so that in giving to her the golden moments of cloudlessness he was losing his chance with the orbs above. Those features which usually attract the eye of the visitor to a new latitude are the novel forms of human and vegetable life, and other such sublunary things. But the young man glanced slightingly at these. The changes overhead had all his attention. The old subject was imprinted there, but in a new type. Here was a heaven, fixed and ancient as the northern, yet it had never appeared above the Welland hills, since they were heaved up from beneath. here was an unalterable circumpolar region, but the polar pattern stereotyped in history and legend, without which it had almost seemed that a polar sky could not exist, had never been seen there. St. Cleeve, as was natural, began by cursory surveys, which were not likely to be of much utility to the world or to himself. He wasted several weeks, indeed above 2 months, in a comparatively idle survey of southern novelties. In the mere luxury of looking at stellar objects whose wonders were known, recounted, and classified, long before his own personality had been heard of. With a child's simple delight, he allowed his instrument to rove, evening after evening, from the gorgeous glitter of Canopus to the hazy clouds of Magellan. Before he had well finished this optical prelude, there floated over to him from the other side of the equator the postscript to the epistle of his lost Viviette. It came in the vehicle of a common newspaper, under the head of Births. April 10th, 18, at the palace, Melchester, the wife of the Bishop of Melchester, of a son. XLI, 3 years passed away, and Swithin still remained at the Cape, quietly pursuing the work that had brought him there. His memoranda of observations had accumulated to a wheelbarrow load, and he was beginning to shape them into a treatise which should possess some scientific utility. He had gauged the southern skies with greater results than even he himself had anticipated. Those unfamiliar constellations which, to the casual beholder, are at most a new arrangement of ordinary points of light, were to this professed astronomer, as to his brethren, a far greater matter. It was below the surface that his material lay. There, in regions revealed only to the instrumental observer, were suns of hybrid kind, fire fogs, floating nuclei, globes that flew in groups like swarms of bees, and other extraordinary sights which, when decomposed by Swithin's equatorial, turned out to be the beginning of a new series of phenomena instead of the end of an old one. There were gloomy deserts in those southern skies such as the north shows scarcely an example of. Sites set apart for the position of suns which for some unfathomable reason were left uncreated, their places remaining ever since conspicuous by their emptiness. The inspection of these chasms brought him a second pulsation of that old horror which he had used to describe to Viviette as produced in him by bottomlessness in the north heaven. The ghostly finger of limitless vacancy touched him now on the other side. Infinite deeps in the north stellar region had a homely familiarity about them, when compared with infinite deeps in the region of the South Pole. This was an even more unknown tract of the unknown. Space here, being less the historic haunt of human thought than overhead at home, seemed to be pervaded with a more lonely loneliness. Were there given on paper to these astronomical exercitations of St. Cleeve a space proportionable to that occupied by his ear with Viviette at Welland, this narrative would treble its length, but not a single additional glimpse would be afforded of Swithin in his relations with old emotions. In these experiments with tubes and glasses, important as they were to human intellect, there was little food for the sympathetic instincts which create the changes in the life. That which is the foreground and measuring base of one perspective draft may be the vanishing point of another perspective draft, while yet they are both drafts of the same thing. Swithin's doings and discoveries in the southern sidereal system were, no doubt, incidents of the highest importance to him, and yet from an intersocial point of view they served but the humble purpose of killing time, while other doings, more nearly allied to his heart than to his understanding, developed themselves at home. In the intervals between his professional occupations he took walks over the sand flats near, or among the farms which were gradually overspreading the country in the vicinity of Cape Town. He grew familiar with the outline of Table Mountain, and the fleecy devil's tablecloth which used to settle on its top, when the wind was southeast. On these promenades he would more particularly think of Viviette, and of that curious pathetic chapter in his life with her which seemed to have wound itself up and ended forever. Those scenes were rapidly receding into distance, and the intensity of his sentiment regarding them had proportionately abated. He felt that there had been something wrong there, and yet he could not exactly define the boundary of the wrong. Viviette's sad and amazing sequel to that chapter had still a fearful, catastrophic aspect in his eyes. But instead of musing over it, and its bearings, he shunned the subject, as we shun by night the shady scene of a disaster, and keep to the open road. He sometimes contemplated her apart from the past, leading her life in the cathedral close at Melchester, and wondered how often she looked south, and thought of where he was. On one of these afternoon walks in the neighborhood of the Royal Observatory, he turned and gazed towards the signal post on the Lion's Rump. This was a high promontory to the northwest of Table Mountain, and overlooked Table Bay. Before his eyes had left the scene, the signal was suddenly hoisted on the staff. It announced that a mail steamer had appeared in view over the sea. In the course of an hour he retraced his steps, as he had often done on such occasions, and strolled leisurely across the intervening mile and a half till he arrived at the post office door. There was no letter from England for him, but there was a newspaper, addressed in the 17th century handwriting of his grandmother, who, in spite of her great age, still retained a steady hold on life. He turned away disappointed, and resumed his walk into the country, opening the paper as he went along. A cross in black ink attracted his attention, and it was opposite a name among the deaths. ... His blood ran icily as he discerned the words "The Palace, Melchester." ... But it was not she. Her husband, the Bishop of Melchester, had, after a short illness, departed this life at the comparatively early age of 50 years. All the enactments of the bygone days at Welland now started up like an awakened army from the ground. But a few months were wanting to the time when he would be of an age to marry without sacrificing the annuity which formed his means of subsistence. It was a point in his life that it had no meaning or interest for him since his separation from Viviette, for women were now no more to him than the inhabitants of Jupiter. But the whirligig of time having again set Viviette free, the aspect of home altered, and conjecture as to her future found room to work anew. But beyond the simple fact that she was a widow, he for some time gained not an atom of intelligence concerning her. There was no one of whom he could inquire but his grandmother, and she could tell him nothing about a lady who dwelt far away at Melchester. Several months slipped by thus, and no feeling within him rose to sufficient strength to force him out of a passive attitude. Then by the merest chance his granny stated in one of her rambling epistles that Lady Constantine was coming to live again at Welland in the old Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.